G'day wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again on truth2u.org. That's truth2u.org. I'm Jono, and joining me is Jason Spiritual Babies. G'day, Mr. Spiritual Babies.
Good evening, and the day, happy Christmas. It's nearly Christmas.
Isn't it Merry Christmas?
Merry.
It's Happy New Year. Happy Christmas.
I know is that the snacks are cheaper in the shops. I've got 18 hours of James Bond films on, and the Bushmills single malt whiskey is £5 less. So, happy Christmas. That's all I know. It does me.
Oh, dear me. Who knows when we're going to publish this, but of course, now you've given it away. It's actually a few days before the day, the silly season. I can't wait till it comes and goes every year. But we happen to be speaking with, by the way, his website is outreachjudaism.org. Outreachjudaism.org. So much information there. So many resources you really need, dear listener, to go and visit there. Check it out, outreachjudaism.org. Rabbi Tovia Singer, welcome back to the program.
Hey, great to be here, both of you, and wish you the best. Thank you.
Wonderful to have you back. Now listen, creature feature. Do we have a creature, a feature creature?
Peacock flounder. That's what we have.
The peacock flounder. Now, before you talk about the peacock...
And Jason is thinking, sounds like dinner. Can I get asparagus on the side? Go ahead.
When you first showed me a picture of the peacock flounder, it reminded me of we see a lot of these on the side of the road in the country, New South Wales of Australia. Right. But it's not roadkill. What is it?
Oh, this is really amazing. The shot, initially I tried to find my own shot, but... A peacock flounder is an extraordinary creature. It starts out as a regular fish. That means it swims vertically. So it's laterally thin. And what happens is, in a few months of its life, it turns on its side. And for the rest of its life, it slides along the ground to find prey and escape predators. Now, there's a problem, and that is it has an eye on each side of its head, like a regular fish when it's a little baby. So when it turns to its side and never goes back to the lateral vertical position, the eye that is now down moves across its face to the right side of its face. So if you look carefully at this unbelievable fish, it has two eyes on one side of its face, but that other eye, the further eye, actually slid over during its formative years, right before the bar mitzvah. Now, one other point. Is this show too advanced for you? I just want to know. Now, the other point about the peacock flounder, which those eyes incidentally move completely independently, 300 and whatever degrees. Aside from that, the peacock flounder, of course, has the ability and can, within seconds, camouflage itself, change its pigmentation to match precisely whatever it's hovering over. It uses the camouflage for two reasons. Number one, to escape predators. Number two, to camouflage itself so it can capture its own prey. It usually takes about 4 to 8 seconds for it to make the transition. And this fish was also tested over a checkerboard. And when it slid over a checkerboard...
Oh, the octopus. Yeah, right. So when it slid over the checkerboard.
Right, when it slid over the checkerboard, it literally, a checkerboard just comes across the whole fish. I've seen this. I follow them as they move through the water. They glide slowly. They're not fast swimmers, given the way their orientation. But they depend completely on their camouflage. It's really astounding when you see it, because it looks like you're in Disney. It doesn't look normal. There's nothing on land, to my knowledge. Well, I guess those geckos, and I'm talking about the insurance. I'm talking about those lizards, whatever may do that. I don't see chameleon. Those in Brooklyn too often. Chameleon. Yeah. But this is really off the wall completely.
This is okay, because when I first saw it, I thought, you know, it looks like a squashed, what once was an animal, and now it's been squished, because it doesn't look like the stingray, for example, clearly is meant to be flat like that. This thing looks like it's been smooshed, and what you're saying is it's not like the stingray, like it doesn't have, you know, all the parts. It is actually a fish that was upright with an eye on either side, fins on either. I mean, is there a fin underneath still?
Yes, but there that is. Collapses. Yes, that collapses, and the eye that slides over its face and then moves on to one side. So you notice there are two eyes there, but it didn't start that way. It starts off with an eye on each side. And if Christopher Hitchens is listening somewhere, wherever the heck he is, he's probably roommates with Yasser Arafat. If you pay attention to this, you could realize that this is a very big mistake you made, because this obviously is incredible.
But you can tell, because it's not the eyes aren't symmetrical. It really looks like it's kind of been smushed. And but what you're telling me is that the eye travels. It doesn't it doesn't go through the head and pop up on the other side. It travels
over the face.
That blows my mind, Jason. Yeah. Come on.
So in Europe, we would call a fish like that a sole. We have Dover sole, who they aren't as pretty. They're one color, and generally you do eat them. And they have both eyes on the same side, because they lay on their side, right? They don't kind of swim along like a regular fish. They lay there like a flat fish.
But they slither along the bottom in shallow areas in particular. But the key is, you see the two eyes on one side when it's born, and in its juvenile stage, it has an eye on each side, and it's moving like a regular fish laterally, vertically.
Does it change color when it's in that state? A juvenile fish, does it change color?
It does change color, but not as well. So it has to be in its juvenile stage. It has to hide between corals and in caves to protect it. Whereas once it becomes an adult, I mean, once it transitions, it then is very effective at camouflage. It's able to escape predators, and it's able to capture based basically on this pigmentation ability. That's astounding.
That is astounding.
I wonder if they always, because what I'm looking at has both eyes on its left side, and I'm wondering if it's always on the left side, or whether you'll get one.
It's on the left side.
Right. Yeah, so is that, and that's like always that way. Yeah, that'd be interesting. Because I mean, if that's the case, you could have two that are like next door to each other, and they can't see each other.
And if they come up next to each other, they'll mirror each other. And
yeah. So and they're like, what are you looking at? And go, who are you talking to?
That is astounding. So listen, just curiously, is it fins and scales?
Yeah, flounder, of course, is kosher.
So we can eat it.
You can eat it, absolutely. Enjoy
if
it.
You can find it.
You have, I'm sure.
I kind of feel creepy. Like I can't imagine one on my plate. It would look like, you know, with its eyes, like, anyway. I don't
have fish on my plate that like looks too real. Like if someone put a fish on like with glasses on my plate, I'd feel very uncomfortable. I want it chopped up. I don't want to see like the whole thing. Like
you don't want to see the full.
I don't want to think like I'm an anatomy class at dinner. I want it chopped up, hidden in a can, or sushi, and then I have no clue what it is.
I'd like to see the pair of glasses that would fit on that face.
So you are a scuba diver, but are you also a fisherman? Are you a keen fisherman as well, or are you really just a scuba diver?
No, scuba diving has a certain culture to it, and that is, on a serious note, when you're down there, you're just one of a few million people in the world that have the privilege to breathe underwater. So as such, you never feel any kind of inkling to harm or injure what you're observing. On the contrary, your mind is blown by the spectacle of God's creation. And it's such a world view in your underwater, in a weightless environment, that the notion of harming or injuring any of these creatures is just not there. It's all about observing them, loving them, and realizing that you have a privilege to be in this position to be able to witness this. It's something like, in a sense, like with the time we're living today spiritually. Do you know, 300 years ago, people would look at prophecies in Ezekiel 38 and 39, which describe end time war. I don't think they understood. They couldn't possibly reckon how would it be that the Jews in Israel will fight off wars against Persia? They had to take the Bible's word for it, but it certainly did not comport with anything that they were observing, because the Jews were living in an Ottoman Empire, powerless, just weak Jews sitting and praying all day, no army, nothing. So they looked at these texts. We talked about looking at passages about Tyre, a nation that was destroyed 2,500 years ago. They had to be asking, why is Tyre over the Bible? We know now, Cyrus, who cares about Cyrus? Why is he called a Messiah in Isaiah 45:1? Why is Cyrus so prominent at the beginning of Ezra if Cyrus's decree was rescinded and eventually it was Artaxerxes, really Esther's own son, that would give the final commands to enable Second Temple? So why Cyrus? Cyrus is rescinded, just like the Balfour Declaration of 1917 was rescinded. The Peel Commission, that means Israel would, what would be the state of Israel, is today Jordan. What is known as Jordan and Israel today, Israel is supposed to have all that. 79% of it was lost when the Hashemite kingdom of Jordan was created just a few years later. And a few years later, in 37, there'd be the Peel Commission creating the state of Israel into two cantons. By the time we reached the partition plan of 1947, England, the United Kingdom, would not vote to support a state of Israel. They abstained. They actually abstain. What is that exactly perfectly aligned with? What the Bible tells about Persia, initially Pau coming out, Cyrus, a non-Jew, a pagan, probably a Zoroastrian. Who do we have as the person who gives that command? A Christian, a premillennial dispensationalist, the Foreign Secretary James Balfour, who was Prime Minister, a Christian. He's giving the command. It's rescinded. So therefore, we are just as, in a sense, and that 100 years ago, it was impossible to witness this. This, the whole notion of a regulator, first stage, second stage, there are two basic systems. This is very recent. So therefore, in the same way that this couldn't be conceivable. So I feel like, wow, what a privilege to be able to gaze on Hashem's wonders. In the same way, we have, all the three of us, we have the ability to look at texts that were no doubt puzzling to previous generations, because the time of the end was not revealed to anyone, according to Jewish tradition, two people, but no one else. Thus, they had no understanding of what today we take for granted.
True. So true. Yeah. So we're in the information age, and what an incredible privilege it is to be in the information age and to be in a time when prophecy is being fulfilled before our eyes, and we can look in the scriptures and go, aha, that's what it means. This must be what it means. This could, is very, very plausible. And we're filled with information, and it is such a privilege. And in the same way, never before in history, in the last 100 years, people have been able to go down underneath the surface of the water and experience the colors and observe the creatures and gain information and be able to even explain how it is that they change color and how it is that their eye moves across their face. Things like that. We live in an amazing time in history, don't we?
Yeah, it is absolutely extraordinary. And that's why I say that diving, let's call it a sport for a moment, has an orientation, a culture to it. And that culture foremost is do no harm. In fact, in marine parks, it is around the world, without exception, forbidden for a scuba diver to hunt. Even for locals, because the advantage you have over other fish is astounding. If you're a diver, you can kill anything because you're swimming with them. You can just shoot them. You can net them in a second. So no marine park in the world permits scuba divers to do any kind of hunting, with the exception of the lionfish in the Caribbean, because they are creating a problem, so they want to eradicate them. But that's for a completely different reason. But scuba diving has an orientation, has a culture, a worldview of, we are there to observe and to touch nothing, let alone harm something.
Now, listen, we have some questions.
We got a ton of questions.
What's another one?
Well, let's have a look. First, thank you, Mary James Crisp. Thank you, James. Thank you, Sherry. Thank you, Ami Adiyar. Thank you, Cindy Liu, and everyone else that posted questions. I have one I'd like to do real kind of quickly. So the Torah portion I was reading the other day mentioned the bridegroom of blood. Oh. And when I checked out the so this is when Moses is in an inn and God was going to kill him, and then he has to the circumcision happens really fast, and she throws down and the foreskin, and she says, "You are a bridegroom of blood to me." And I thought, well, I wonder what that word for bridegroom is. So I looked it up, and I noticed it is used for son-in-law in a few places as well. And it was confusing to me. It's been confusing to me for years.
What does she mean? So this is Sapporah. Mm-hmm. This is Sapporah who takes the flint knife, circumcises the son, throws the foreskins at his feet, I think it says, or something to that effect, and says, "You are a bridegroom of blood to me." And she's clearly not a happy camper, and it had to be done. It was it's a commandment. So, Tobia.
Let me move in here. I want to say something, and then you guys tell me if what I'm saying makes sense. Okay. I would posit that Moses placing that couple, the family, in danger of being killed because the child wasn't circumcised would make that frame, that term, which means chatan damim, which means a groom or a husband who brings about blood, makes all the sense in the world. There was nearly death brought about to Moses for not circumcising the son. So what she said, I would think, and again, we're talking about Genesis 4, I think it's 25,
Exodus 4.
26, yeah. Something like that.
Yeah. Exodus so, chapter 4, yeah.
So I would say, and if you disagree, tell me, but to me what makes sense is the fact that she would be upset at the predicament that Moses would create by not circumcising his son. That makes all the sense. That's the part of this text that requires, in my eyes, doesn't require much explanation. She was clearly disturbed that Moses neglected to circumcise his child. I think, and I'll just pass this, the conundrum here, the thing that's mysterious is a different question altogether. And that is, why didn't Moses circumcise his child? That's the question, I think, which has a fabulous answer. But I don't. The fact that she would be disturbed that her husband would nearly brought about death in the family, so her referring to him using that language makes all the sense in the world. Does that make sense to both of you?
I've never looked at it in that perspective before. I've always assumed that it was the act, it was having to do it at that point that caused that response from her. That the act caused that response, not the the waiting for that act, or the fact that Moses had caused that issue in her, in their lives.
Well, that's context.
I've never heard that perspective before.
I mean, it means it's a simple, the simplest, most plain reading of the text is of Exodus, chapter 4, is that Moses, for some reason, disregards this monumental, important principle to circumcise your son and nearly brings about his death. I mean, he almost dies, and she's going, "What have you done?" She grabs the knife, the flint knife, to do what he should have carried out, and therefore she stems off. She forestalls, she protects the family, and she turns towards him and said, "What did you do? You nearly got us killed here." So well, yeah, that but makes sense.
Okay,
the question
it does.
Is, why did Moses not circumcise? So well, that requires an answer.
If I may speculate, and this is purely speculation, this is not in the text, but if I'm trying to read between the lines, Tobia, for me, she seems to know what to do immediately. It's like, oh, we haven't done this. Perhaps there was a discussion. Maybe it's not a Midianite practice to circumcise. Maybe it was something abhorrent to her. Maybe she put her foot down and protested against him saying, This is the Torah of my God. I need to do this. And she goes, you're not going to touch my sons in that way. You're not going to do that, perhaps. And so when God confronted Moses and angry because and going to kill him because he had not circumcised his son and entered them into the covenant, then she suddenly realized, oh, no, he's right. I have to do it. And so she whips into action. She knew exactly what to do. She took a flint knife. She did the thing. And then she was, what I reading between the lines, there seems to kind of be a resentment from her to him, and yet it was done. And it says in Exodus chapter 4, verse 24 through to 26, and it came to pass on the way at the encampment that the Lord met him and sought to kill him. Then Zipporah
Moses, right.
Yeah, yeah. And so, Zipporah took a sharp stone and cut off the foreskins of her son and cast it at Moses' feet and said, "Surely you are a husband of blood to me." So he, God, let him go. And then she said, "You are a husband of blood." And I've got an exclamation mark on that. I know it's not in the text, but because of the circumcision is what it says, and that's all it says about it.
So which narrative then is more consistent with that? The narrative, it seems obvious to me, the narrative is that he, for whatever reason, did not circumcise his child. She then did the right thing and circumcised the child and therefore saved the couple from death.
True.
That's the plain reading. And in fact, the plain reading, I think, is obvious. The question is, what's going on here? What's the metadata? That means, why didn't Moses perform such a simple commandment that has its antecedent back to Abraham, such a central feature of what it means to be from the royal family? And that's where the context come in. What was Moses thinking? Was he out of his mind not to circumcise his child?
I have to think that he was bowing to the wishes of his Midian wife and not doing it. That's why she knew what to do. There's another reason. Okay.
There's a reason for it. The reason is the exact same reason why the Jews didn't circumcise themselves until they finally arrived in the land of Israel with Joshua. Mm-hmm. The reason is that circumcision is a life-threatening procedure, infection and so on. And a person has to be able to rest for at least, according to Jewish tradition, 3 days without moving so they would not get an infection because one could die. So after 3 days, there's a healing that takes place. Therefore, the children of Israel, while traveling through the wilderness, because they didn't know when the cloud which hovered above them would move next, they couldn't be circumcised because they had no idea if they would be able to stay long enough to remain healthy. So when they come into the land, they get circumcised. That was precisely Moses' thinking. Mm-hmm. Look at the context so you know that I'm not – what's happening is – go back, I think it's verse 20. I don't have a Bible in front of me, but for 20 or 21, you have there a traveling. That means the family are going on a donkey, and they are returning to Egypt. So Moses is in the exact same conundrum as the children of Israel would be in the wilderness, which would ultimately resolve. So his thinking was the following. Even though there was an imperative to circumcise my son now, we're traveling. We're going on donkeys. We are going back to the land of Egypt. Can I circumcise my child while we're traveling? The answer, he thought, is we should wait because this would present danger to the child. We're not reaching here because, no, this is precisely what would forestall the children of Israel from being circumcised until they finally passed the Jordan and rested in the land of Israel where they knew there was no cloud. They can move impulsively. They can move on their own. Therefore, that's what Moses was thinking here.
Now, I know what the listeners are saying is, then why did not God confront the Israelites in the wilderness and threaten to kill them because they weren't circumcising? We're talking about circumcising a child on the eighth day. It's not as if the child is on the 8 days old is going to be trekking through the wilderness. They're going to be in their mother's arms in a sling or whatever it may be. And this becomes the question then. Is that fair?
Well, I think I understand what your question is. It's a central tenet. I mean, God does this for Abraham. Abraham gets circumcised, and God brings about such a heat. And it's interesting. It says the heat of the day in Genesis 18. Why? God wants Abraham to relax because he's just been circumcised. He was an old man.
Sure.
The principle, the driving principle here in all these examples we've selected is there was an imperative not to move someone who has just been circumcised. Remember, obviously, we can go back just 100 years ago, there were no antibiotics. Having an open wound invited infection. So this principle was guarded very carefully, and therefore people did not circumcise a child, or typically didn't, if there was any chance of movement. With a cloud hovering over the nation, they in fact forestalled that ritual until they would finally arrive in the land of Israel. In the same way, Moses was wondering, maybe I should forestall this circumcision until I arrive in Egypt with my donkeys. It was a miscalculation, but Moses meant well, which means Moses wasn't in rebellion against God, but he had in fact brought upon himself a existential, not only himself, but his family, his wife, which she's going to become upset with. But that's, it's important people go like, what was Moses thinking? Like, why did Moses carry out such a basic tradition? The answer is that's what, that was his calculation.
That was his calculation, but that's, but it the appears context. It appears it was the wrong calculation. It appears that God was upset with that.
Moses should have known that God would have protected him. That means uniquely him. In the wilderness, the Jews were simply following what Moses would tell them, and they had that instruction. But Moses didn't. He relied on his own intuition, his wife. And we see this theme consistently, where the woman has this innate sense. Whether it's Abraham, who God says, listen to your wife, Sarah, she understands, or here we have another example where the wife understands. She's truly the Sophia Halicha Spesa. The woman really is the guardian, the watch person over the home. She has the intuition of what goes on in the home. And we see that theme repeatedly. Again, you mentioned earlier Isaac and Rebecca. Isaac was blinded. He didn't recognize the character of his two sons. He had sort of blurred that. The Bible uses the term that Isaac was blinded. The blinded could be understood, obviously, literally, he was blind. But also, there is a sense that he was blind to the distinction between Esau and Jacob. But Rebekah, the wife, she knew, she understood, and therefore she had to do what's necessary. Do you see this repeating theme where the wife intercedes, and God essentially is going, listen to your wife, she understands.
Okay, Jason.
Well, no, it's, you know, I think both perspectives are very interesting. And but then the whole point of this program is that we get the information out. People can dig in, take what they hear here, dig into the text, figure out what their basis of belief is. Both plausible. If this was Mythbusters, plausible.
You've been plausible on both of those. Now, listen, just while we're in this passage, you know, this is off the topic, Toby, but it's only two verses earlier, and I just love this. And while we're here, I have to read it. Exodus chapter 4, verse 22. Then you shall say, you, Moses, shall say to Pharaoh, thus says Yehovah, Israel is my son, my firstborn. And so you will say, let my son go that he may serve me. But if you refuse to let him go, indeed, I will kill your son, your firstborn. A highly significant verse, and I thought I'd just better chuck that in the program. So that's all we have time for today. Thank you so much, Tovia Singer. OutreachJudaism.org is the website, OutreachJudaism.org, Mr. Spiritual Babies. And until next week, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's Word. Shalom.